WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If the O.J. Simpson trial has inspired you to learn more about forensics, we've got the guest for you. Dr. Michael Bodden is a forensic pathologist, a medical examiner who performs autopsies on people who have died unnatural or mysterious deaths. Dr. Bodden is co-director of the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police. He also investigates cases as a consultant to the FBI. He consulted on the investigations into the Kennedy and King assassinations and worked on the cases of Klaus von Bülow, Tawana Brawley, John Belushi, and the World Trade Center bombing. He's now working with the Simpson defense team. Dr. Bodden is the author of a 1989 memoir called Unnatural Death. Before we hear the interview we recorded last January, let me warn you that his descriptions of his work are sometimes pretty graphic. I asked what kinds of bodies he examines.
There are over 2 million deaths a year in this country. It works out about 92% of all deaths are natural deaths, cancer, heart disease, stroke. And those bodies usually are attended to by the treating physician, and death certificates are issued. When death is unnatural, in those 8% of cases, homicide, suicide, accident, they're referred for investigation to the medical examiner or coroner and for determination of cause of death.
Now, as you point out in your book, a medical examiner can not only determine the cause of death in an unnatural death, but the medical examiner becomes an early warning system in identifying new diseases and other problems in society. What kinds of things?
We see any new drug that comes in, with designer drugs, if a new form of LSD or a new form of a narcotic drug comes into the community, we often are the first to identify the drug by finding it in dead people on chemical analysis. We find patterns of disease. If there's suddenly an increase in heart disease deaths in a certain group, as has been found in cocaine users, we can call that to public attention. If somebody comes from another country and dies of a potentially contagious disease, we're the ones who have to identify that disease as people coming from foreign countries through Kennedy Airport, where we found that a number of times.
Let's talk a little bit about the autopsy process. When you're looking at a body, I imagine the first thing you do is just look at it before you even open it up. What are some of the things,
Terry,
that you can...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Even before what you say, to do a proper medical legal investigation of an unnatural death, the first part of it is going to the scene where the body is.
Oh, you go there.
That's correct. In a proper investigation, there's a tremendous amount of information at the scene of death. When I get called on a case that require, or any medical exam that requires medical exam investigation, going to the scene to find out how long a body has been dead, to find out if there are any hairs or fibers or semen or saliva on the body that have to be identified and protected, is critical. Once the body is brought to the autopsy table, and the first time I see that body is on the autopsy table, I've already lost a lot of the scientific information that might be useful in the further investigation of the death.
What can you tell by just looking at a dead body? How can you tell by looking at it how long it's been dead?
The body's been dead, we can tell by testing for the changes that occur if the body dies. It's amazing, Terry, we go through life, and if we cut ourselves, we always have red blood coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But about 45% of our blood is solid, is red cells and white cells. And we don't appreciate that. In addition to the heart pumping the blood all around the body, it also churns the blood up. When we give blood in a blood bank, you can see readily how about half the plastic bag fills up with red stuff at the bottom and yellow fluid on the top. That's how the blood normally would separate out. And the reason it doesn't separate out like that in our bodies is because of the churning action of the heart. Once the heart stops beating, the blood stops getting churned up, the red cells start settling down just as it would in a blood bank, And it takes time to discolor the body. Within a few hours, the lower portions of the body have this maroon discolored look caused by the settling red cells, and that gives us an idea of how long somebody's been dead. It tells us if the body's been moved after death or not. So that by looking at the body, one can tell if a person's freshly dead or has been dead 12 hours or in between. In addition to that, we have the stiffness of the body. Even, you know, Quincy and Poirot would go to that, is you can feel the joints and feel how the muscle tightens up because it's not getting the waste products taken away that the blood usually does. And as the urea and the other things build up, the muscles stiffen. And that tells us an idea of how long somebody's been dead. And also the temperature change.
There's a lot that the stomach can tell you when you're doing an autopsy. What could it tell you?
How digestion proceeds, and I like to refer to paraphrase Professor Einstein, that God does not play dice with digestion. When we eat something, the digestion proceeds in an orderly manner. Most meals will be processed by the stomach in less than 2 hours. So if we eat something at breakfast at 8 o'clock, 95% of what we've eaten will have been processed and pushed out of the stomach into the small intestine by 10 o'clock in the morning. If we find somebody who has a stomach full of food, it would indicate that person had died less than 2 hours. Also, the stomach contents give us an idea as to what the person ate. If the person ate steak or carrots or vegetables, those materials can be identified in the stomach, and we can determine whether or not the person ate the last known meal or went out someplace else and ate a meal. Sometimes this becomes very important in establishing whether a person's information alibi is correct. When a person dies can become a very important aspect of an investigation.
One stomach revelation that helps solve the case, there's a story in one of your cases in which within the stomach there was pretty much a raw French fry, an undigested French fry, and the French fry had a very distinctive cut to it. And by looking at that cut, one of the police on the case recognized the diner that this person must have eaten in, and that basically helped solve the whole mystery.
Yeah, I think, and he taught me something. It's amazing when the police come to autopsies and district attorneys come to the autopsy, how we learn from each other. In this particular case you're referring to, after I looked at the stomach contents and I said, look, it looks like this young lady had died less than an hour or two after eating, so if you find who her boyfriend was and whom she ate with, there's a good chance that he's involved in the death. He looked at the material and said, Doc, I can do you one better, because the nature, the way that French fry was cut was not the usual McDonald's fast food restaurant, but was done in a way that a certain diner that the police officer would eat at recognized, and that's what solved the crime. And he was able on that basis to find out who this unidentified woman was and to solve the crime.
He was able to go to the diner, give him a picture of the dead woman. They recognized the dead woman at the diner and knew who she had her last meal with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is how our leads can help. But it's a mutual process. And I think with the, you know, what's happened, when I started out in this field in the 1960s, most homicides were solved by confessions.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, confessions don't have the same weight as they used to for various reasons, some very good. But there's also been a burgeoning of scientific evidence that's independent material that can tell what happened without the confession. And unless the doctors doing the autopsies know how to to read the body. You said how we look at a body, we talk with a dead body from our experience. Unless there are doctors trained to do this, the homicide resolution rate, accountability, is going to diminish even further. What? Why would people stop killing other people if, for example, there was no reasonable chance they were going to get caught? It has to be shown that if somebody commits a homicide, there's a reasonable chance he's going to be caught and brought to justice and go to jail. Less than half of all murderers in this country spend any jail time. And part of that is because we're not using the forensic evidence, the scientific evidence, the stomach contents evidence, etc.
Do you think of yourself as part detective, part doctor?
I think of myself as part detective, but not in the Quincy sense. You see, my concern is not who done it. My concern is what happened. I'm a detective in how people die and what kind of evidence they leave behind. Whenever two people come into contact, each leaves something of the other on the other individual.
What, like a hair, a fiber?
Hairs, fibers, semen, blood. In order for a perpetrator to get into a house, he's got to walk over. He's got to walk. There's often shoe prints, tire prints. All this evidence becomes important in identifying who was there, who did what to whom. Getting the clothing of the suspect is important, as well as getting the clothing of the decedent, because there's a transfer of information. We shake hands. We transfer bacteria. Occasionally, bacteria have been used to solve crimes. So there's a lot of scientific evidence that can be used that replaces much more fairly the confession. But most jurisdictions lose the value of solving cases by confession and have not had the ability to use the scientific evidence. We have more than a dozen states in this country that don't have a single forensic pathologist, single medical examiner who's trained in this area in the whole state.
My guest is forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Michael Bodden, medical examiner. He's director of New York State's Forensic Sciences Unit, and he consults to the FBI. Now, you headed the forensic pathology investigation for the 1977 Congressional Commission on Assassinations. You reviewed the evidence in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and you believe that it was a single bullet.
Yeah, well, there were two bullets, but one of them was the so-called magic bullet that Oliver Stone doesn't like. Clearly, in reviewing President Kennedy's autopsy, lots of mistakes were made in that autopsy. It was a poorly done autopsy by forensic standards, by medical examiner standards. But the bottom line, two rifle wounds from behind, from the area where Oswald was, and only two bullets struck the president from behind. One, the single bullet, went through, exited the president's neck, and then struck Governor Connally and went through Governor Connally and was found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital. There's no magic about it. That bullet went in the normal straight pattern that bullets go in. That was our conclusion. You know, just a sadness that anybody looking at the Zapruder film would have known immediately that the president died of this bullet wound of the head, and there was a second bullet wound that struck him in the back. The cause of death wasn't what was important with President Kennedy. It was all the attendant information, which was an entrance wound at autopsy, what was an exit wound, much of which was done poorly. And it is, I thought, and we members of the committee 30 years ago, thought this would be a wake-up call to the country that this death of President Kennedy is a reflection on the poor ability that this country has to investigate murders, because doctors don't know the difference in entrance wounds and exit wounds normally, as with President Kennedy. But instead, the country and Oliver Stone and all the critics seized upon the errors as being unique, that the only reason there were mistakes made was because there's a cover-up on the president. In actual fact, it was the usual way that autopsies were done 30 years ago by untrained pathologists in forensic pathology. And sadly, it is the same type of autopsies that's going on today.
Now, I know that you're working on the Joel Rifkin case, the case of a serial killer in Long Island. Were you in on identifying that several murders were the work of one killer?
In part. My role in Joel Rifkin is part of the New York State Police Forensic Sciences Unit, and it's just an odd situation where an alert New York State Police trooper stopping a car that didn't have proper license plates noticed from odor that there was a decomposing body in the car, spoke to Rifkin, and Rifkin said, I've killed 17 people. We did not know there was a serial murderer out there killing these prostitutes until he confessed to it. And that's, again, part of the deficiencies we have in death investigation. These deaths occurred over many different counties in New York and maybe New Jersey. And when the bodies were found, many of these bodies were not called homicides. They were called cocaine overdose. They were called drowning. And it's just a sadness with Joel Rifkin that when the police rely on the medical examiner or coroner to investigate a death, and if the medical examiner or coroner misses that it's a homicide, the police have no idea that they're looking for a serial murderer. So with Joel Rifkin, again, it's a message to us that we've got to get our act together. And when autopsies are done and people are murdered, if we don't identify them, they're going to repeat those murders. And that's happening more and more. There are more serial murders now. For whatever reason, people can move better nowadays. And unless we stop a serial murder after one or two or three deaths, a string of them are going to happen afterwards. But in the situation, the role of the New York State Police was in part to work with the different counties to confirm the identification of who these people were and to establish the cause of death. And in fact, these causes of death were suffocation or strangulation, not drowning or cocaine overdose.
What does it do to you psychologically to be working so much with the dead?
That's a frequent question that medical examiners are asked. When we see the dead body, they're out of their misery. It isn't the dead who are in pain. It's the people who are dying. And it's the relatives of people who are dead. But doing autopsies, going to an autopsy room where there may be a half a dozen people who were alive yesterday, who are dead today, isn't as upsetting as going into a cancer ward in a hospital where people are dying gradually from their illnesses. But we know when we go to the autopsy table and somebody has died of alcohol or drugs or a poorly designed automobile, when we didn't have seatbelts, our job is to learn from the dead. This is a tradition among all pathologists. How do we learn from the dead to help the living? And in that sense, it isn't as depressing as it sounds. We also work with living victims. Seeing the living battered child is more depressing to me, to look at the marks and the injuries and say, no, this couldn't have happened in the innocent way the mother says it happened. Somebody intentionally beat up the child. That's much more depressing to me than finding a dead baby who's already out of his or her misery. Because I know when I say to the police, this child was battered, it's not innocent, the difficulties there are still in protecting the child from its hostile environment. We're not set up to provide proper rearing of children who are being beaten up.
You said that you like to learn from the dead how to help the living. Is there an example of that you can give us?
Well, I think seatbelts are very important. When I started out as a medical examiner, we used to see deaths of passengers and drivers with their necks cut through by the glass on the windshield. There were no restraint systems. Babies used to be impaled on ornaments and radio knobs that would stick out of the dashboard. Because of work that medical examiners have done in defining that people die from the secondary impact injury has helped lead to better restraint systems, to safety glass on the windows, to dashboards that aren't hazards when somebody gets into an accident, even to seat belts. So I think the whole area of automobile safety has greatly benefited from the findings that medical examiners have made at autopsy.
Does your line of work make you worry more about violent death, about becoming a victim?
Not so much about becoming a victim. And it's amazing, Terry, when you say, when you get up and testify in court and you see the bad guys as defendants, do you get worried about retribution? Absolutely not. Never have I heard in this country, except on Perry Mason, of the bad guy taking out the outcome of being found guilty on the medical examiner. I sort of have the feeling that we're both professionals. He's there listening to see how well I got it. I always have the feeling after I testify, I want to go up to the defendant, if he's guilty or whatever, and say, did I get it right? Where could I learn from how the blows were occurred? But there's no danger that way. I think that clearly we see the casualness which people are killed in this country. And it's just mind-boggling how life doesn't mean what it used to mean when I was growing up, when I was a kid. People, and this has lots of problems involved, but one of the problems that has to be addressed is you got to find out who done it. And the only way you're going to find out who done it is if you have better medical examiners to start off as to find out what happened and how it happened. And that isn't being done.
Dr. Michael Bodden is a forensic pathologist. He co-directs the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police, and he's now working with the Simpson Defense Team. Our interview was recorded last January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.